From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
Climate change, adapting to the inevitable. Hello again, I'm Owen Alney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. Climate change is no longer a question of if or when. The impact of warming is evident right now, and so is the human contribution. Even if greenhouse gas emissions are significantly reduced, the change is inevitable. So it's time to prepare for floods, droughts, and other catastrophes. That's the latest from an international panel with hundreds of scientists from more than 100 countries. On To the Point, who will be hit the hardest? What does it mean to prepare? What are the potential consequences in the United States? On Reporter's Notebook later on, President Bush, immigration reform, and differences that cross party lines. First, here's the news.
Support for To the Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
Hello again, Marvin Alney back with To the Point. Climate change due to global warming is inevitable. In fact, it's happening now. On To the Point, what are the potential consequences for people in the United States and around the world? What can be done to prepare? On Reporter's Notebook, from Arizona's border with Mexico to new battles on Capitol Hill, President Bush revisits immigration reform. First, this news update on this fourth anniversary of the fall of Baghdad. Tens of thousands of anti-American protesters draped themselves in Iraqi flags today in the holy cities of Kufa and Najaf. They were marching to the tune of the powerful Shiite cleric Muqtada al-Sadr. Edward Wong is in Baghdad for the New York Times. And Edward, thanks very much for joining us.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. What appears to have been the immediate goal?
The goal of the protest was basically, I think it can be interpreted to basically be a sign of a show of power by Muqtada al-Sadr, basically to show that he's still relevant, even though he's been in hiding since mid-February when the Americans began their new security plan.
So if he's in hiding, how can this be a show of support?
Well, the fact that he was able to rally so many people and have them march in a unified whole in sort of what is the center of power for the religious Shiites is fairly impressive. The only other person who's been able to do this so far in Iraq is Grand Ayatollah Ali al-Sistani, who's the most revered Shiite cleric in Iraq. But other than him, Muqtada is the only other person who's been able to exert this power.
We've heard very little lately of Ayatollah Sistani. I'm sure you've heard about him in Baghdad, but there hasn't been much in the press about him. Does there appear to be a competition of sorts between the two?
I think since Muqtada started gaining power after the fall of Saddam Hussein, it's been clear that a lot of the older clerics, including Sistani, see him as an upstart and as a potential rival. I mean, Muqtada al-Sadr is not considered a senior cleric by any means, but he does command a popular following that that none of the older clerics command on the same level.
Muqtada al-Sadr also, of course, has representatives in the elected assembly. Are they likely to do something on a unified basis that will be trouble for the Maliki government?
Well, it depends on who you're talking about in the Maliki government. I mean, the prime minister is sort of beholden to Muqtada al-Sadr because Sadr supported him in his bid for his job. And so in many ways, the Sadr movement and the prime minister's office are closely intertwined. But there are other elements in the government that that really oppose the Sadrists and oppose their presence in the government. That includes obviously, the Sunni Arabs, as well as even other Shiites, like a group that's commonly known as Skiri, which is also another very conservative Shiite group that sees Sadr as a rival.
Talking again with Edward Wong, New York Times reporter in Baghdad. Well, I gather in Baghdad itself today, while there was the marching in these other cities, there was a curfew on automobiles, 24-hour curfew. How empty were the streets of the city?
It was pretty empty. The government has done this before when they fear that there might be a surge in violence in Baghdad. They'll basically have a clampdown on any traffic. It usually is fairly effective in keeping car bombers off the street, and we saw that today. It was pretty quiet.
What's the relationship between what Muqtada al-Sadr is doing in Najaf and Kufa and what's going on in Baghdad, the effort by the United States and the Iraqis to establish order there?
Well, since the Baghdad security plan began, some of the activities that the U.S. attributes to the Mahdi Army militia, which Sadr commands, have been on the decline. The Americans say they found less bodies from execution-style slayings in the capital, and they say this is because the Mahdi Army is not as active. Some Mahdi Army commanders have told us that they've been given orders to lie low while the security plan is going on so as not to provoke a direct confrontation with the U.S. So that's partly all tied into the fact that Muqtada has gone into hiding, is underground somewhere. He probably called this demonstration to take place in Najaf so as not to get entangled in the security plan here in Baghdad.
So I guess the question then is what will happen next, and nobody can know. It's been a bloody weekend. There were 10 American soldiers killed in 5 attacks over this weekend. Was there violence today as well?
There's been some clashes in Diwaniya in the south where American and Iraqi forces have been fighting some Sadr militiamen, though it's unclear whether those militiamen down there are directly controlled by Sadr. But today was the fourth day of fighting, and the Americans held a press conference down there, and they said that at least one American soldier was killed and one wounded during fighting over the weekend there.
Okay. Well, Edward Wong, as always, good to have you with us. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Warren.
New York Times, a reporter in Baghdad. In a moment, climate change, adapting to the inevitable. On To the Point.
To the Point thanks Factiva, a Dow Jones and Reuters company, for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 8,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
Warman, I'll be back with To the Point. After 4 days of debate between scientists and government bureaucrats from more than 100 countries, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change released the second in a series of reports on climate change. That was last week. The first concluded with 90% certainty that human activity is the main cause of global warming, or has been since 1950. Co-chair of the team that wrote the latest report is Dr. Martin Parry. Good to have you with us on our program.
You're welcome.
What do you think is the most significant finding in this second report?
I think there are two things, Warren. Firstly, the IPCC now reports a clear conclusion that we can see the observed effects at the global level of climate change on plants and animals and other aspects of the world's surface. 10 years ago, the IPCC reported an anthropogenic signal, that is a man-made effect on climate change. That was in its second assessment. Then 5 years ago, it reported a regional effect of this man-made climate change on plants and animals. And now what we've done is, through the work of Cynthia Rosenzweig and others at NASA in the U.S., is a signal at the global effect, at the global level. So climate change, we conclude, is affecting the world at the global level now. That's something new. That's the first point. Secondly, what we conclude is that the future impacts of climate change will be stronger than we thought the next 2 or 3 decades, we estimate, rather than the next generation or our grandchildren, and mainly on 2 different areas. The regions being those such as the Arctic, because of high levels of temperature increase projected, and semi-arid areas in the north part of Africa and the southern part of Africa. That's north of the Sahara and around the Sahara and southern Africa from Zimbabwe southwards. And the sectors, finally, about these future effects in the next 2 or 3 decades, particularly agriculture in the dry tropics, those areas that are sensitive already, and secondly, marginal ecosystems such as at coasts, that's corals and mangroves, and also small islands. And the bottom line really is it's the marginal areas and peoples that are affected. Ecosystems that are at the edge of things, like the semi-arid regions around deserts, coastal ecosystems such as mangroves and corals, and about people, it's the elderly, the poor and the marginalized, essentially those that have a low adaptive capacity.
The question then becomes, how affected will they be? What can you say about that now that you couldn't say before?
Well, we have numbers now that we didn't have before. We can talk about hundreds of millions of people at risk of flooding in the Asian mega deltas, the Mekong, the Ganges, the big Chinese deltas. These are areas of very dense populations. They're growing very rapidly. They have low adaptive capacity. There are a lot of poor people there. Numbers in the hundreds of millions up to the billion by the middle of the century. For people scarce of water in the future, in the tens, if not hundreds of millions. So we're talking about large numbers of people. They're quartered in particular parts of the world. You might not notice them in North America, but they're there, and they will be knocking on your door if impacts like these happen.
And how soon is this likely to take place?
Well, we used to be thinking in terms of our grandchildren or future generations. Now we think, firstly, that some impacts are occurring now. This is the beginning of the signal, and we reckon that these will ramp up over time and significant effects over the next two or three decades.
Again, Martin Perry is co-chair of the working group number two, I should say, of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. Steve Schneider was one of the authors of this report, the IPCC report. He's a climate scientist at Stanford University, former consultant to the White House in the Nixon, Carter, Reagan, Bush Senior, and Clinton administrations. He's author of many books, including Global Warming, Are We Entering the Greenhouse Century? Steve Schneider, good to have you with us.
Well, glad to be there.
Mr. Perry said that perhaps we couldn't see the effects of this yet in North America. What does this mean for North America, and very particularly the United States?
Well, we've seen effects in North America. There have been heat waves. There's been increasing amount of warmth, decreasing snowpack. You could argue about how much of the super hurricane season a few years ago, the intensity of the hurricanes were cranked up by warming. We know that warm water is what drives the intensity of storms. Nobody's ever said that that global warming will increase the number of storms, just that the basic underlying conditions of the physics is such that when everything else is equal, if the water is hotter, the storm's going to be stronger, and there's a substantial increase, you know, more than 10% in the number of Category 4 and 5 hurricanes since 1970, both Atlantic and Pacific, where the water is warmer. So we're human activity is responsible for 3 inches of Katrina storm surge or a couple of feet, we'll never know. It's one storm. But those effects are probably already being felt. And IPCC said it was more likely than not that this is not just an accident for now, and that it's likely in the future that we'll see these. So this is there. And for people out in California, where we're a Mediterranean climate, like Martin Perry said, the North Africa, Spain, places like that, any place where it doesn't rain much in the summer and you're going to have a hotter summer, you're going to melt the snow earlier in the Sierras, so you have a bigger chance of earlier spring floods, a longer dry season, when you need the water more, and this is a wildfire alley. And one of the reasons I think California's had such a bipartisan response is there's no such thing as a Democratic wildfire and a Republican flood. So we've been pretty on together with our Republican governor and Democratic legislature in trying to do something about it, because we happen to be one of the more vulnerable zones, given the fact that we're a Mediterranean climate, as Martin Perry said.
For our listeners around the rest of the country, how are they expected to be affected? First of all, in the rest of the Southwest, then in the Southeast, and even New England. What are they looking at?
Well, already hot places will have to deal with increased air conditioning demand. The biggest fear we have isn't just the costs of that or the stagnation air pollution that's associated when you burn more coal or gas to produce the electricity. It's what if you go over the top and you have a blackout? The last time you want to have a blackout is on a very hot day. So that's a concern that they'll have to pay attention to. They're also, for the most part, in the Southeast and Hurricane Alley. So if there's going to be, as is now considered likely, increases in the intensities of the top-end storms, doesn't mean they're going to happen more often. Just means that when they happen, they could be real doozies. That's certainly something that has the insurance company very concerned, and I'd be worried about if I were down there. The people in the tops of mountains or in high areas where there are glaciers who need the glacier for water or for other things. They have some concern. And if I were an indigenous person living in the Arctic, like the Inuits, whose culture is linked to sea ice touching the coast, already my culture is vanishing in front of my very eyes. Nobody's going to die from it, but it's certainly a dramatic change for them or the polar bear ecosystem. They don't have a high impact on our GDP. So if you're going to deal about them, you have to have a moral perspective, not just an economic one.
Steve Schneider, again, one of the authors of the IPCC report at climate scientist at Stanford University. Martin Perry, let me go back to you. You said, first of all, the two principal impacts were that there is observed facts on a global level. Now, there are observed facts on a global level. You've been quoted as saying we're not waving around models anymore. We're actually talking about tangible evidence. But then you also talked about the future impacts and how much stronger they might be than you had thought. Aren't those future impacts based on computer models?
Yes. I mean, that is the difference I was trying to make when you used my word, we're not armoring anymore. When we can detect, as we believe we can now, and we've concluded that there are observed effects of climate change at the global level, then as scientists we would call this empirical evidence. That is, it's measurable information that one can touch, see, and record. And that's important because it substantiates other work that we have modeled. Okay, now let's go back to the future. When we look at the future, what we do is we use our understanding of how plants and animals and agricultural practices such as agriculture respond to weather. We know a lot, for example, how crop yields respond in warm years and cold years, both from experience and also as we experiment with them in hothouses. And we use that to build computer simulations, we call them models, and we then experiment with those models. That is to say, let's ask the question, if temperatures were 1, 2, or 3 degrees warmer, what would be the impacts? Okay, now in that second case then, what we have concluded now in the IPCC is that some of the effects which we thought were far off 70, 80 years, our grandchildren or the next generations not yet born, might well happen earlier than we thought, as we had reported in the third assessment 5 years ago. That's what I mean by saying that we may be reasonably expect some important effects within the next 20 or 30 years, while we previously have thought that these were far off down the line. So what is the conclusion from that? We don't have so long to deal with this than we thought. We need to put in place some concrete actions to meet this challenge.
We want to talk about those concrete actions. Before we do, though, you're well aware that there are people, scientists included, not all of them in the pay of the energy industry, who say, wait a minute, we can't predict the weather next week or next month, let alone decades into the future. How is it that you can, with a considerable degree of certainty, tell us what's liable to happen in 2040, but again, have trouble telling us what's going to happen next month?
Right. Well, we're not saying we can predict the weather in 30 or 40 years. The weather is highly variable, sometimes quite random, and it varies massively around the average. But climate is average weather. And we do have a stronger science, particularly over the last 30 years, a strengthening science that can say something about these averages. And that's what we're doing. We're saying that on average, over decades, there will be these important effects. Right. Admittedly, and that's, I concur with the skeptics on that, as the way you put it, Warren, is that around these averages, there will be important variations. There'll be warm years, there'll be cold years, just as there always have been. But imagine that up and down, as it were, draw a graph of this up and down, bouncing around. The trend will be upwards, and quite discernibly and strongly upwards. And so what you will have from that is more frequent warm years that potentially can have damaging effects. Of course, in some places, it could have good effects. It can reduce the demand for heating, for space heating, for warming of houses in Northern Europe and North America and Siberia. It does have a plus side in some areas. But if you stack all these positive and negatives to balance them up, stack them up and balance them out, the negatives really come out more strongly. and that is a conclusion of this UN panel.
Steve Snyder, right back to you, also one of the authors of the report. Back to the issue of the United States. Martin Perry is able to say that he thinks that in a relatively short time, hundreds of millions, if not billions of people around the world, particularly in Asia and Africa, the places he talked about, are going to be affected by this. How soon are the strongest effects, do you think, going to be felt here in the United States?
Well, I think the strongest effects that we'll feel in the short run will be hurricanes that might be more intense than they would have been. As I said earlier, it's very hard to pick one out of the crowd and know how much is less and how much was nature. But there's an increasing pattern. I think the other kinds of strong effects are heat waves, probably air stagnation events. I would expect in California and other parts of the dry West that fire seasons will get a little more risky already. Fire groups are starting to gear up to deal with that. So I think that's where we'll have vulnerabilities.
But how soon? How soon will it be significantly worse than it has been, let's say, for the last 10 years?
Well, it's been significantly worse in Hurricane Alley in terms of the increase in the number of Category 4 and 5 hurricanes over the last 30 years, and there's been two studies now which show that. And although it's very complicated and nobody assigns high confidence to it, it's certainly more likely than not. And that's one thing to worry about. Water supplies in California already, the snowpack is melting 2 weeks earlier in California over this century than it did before. It's amazing how that mobilized the attention of the state bureaucracies because water is the lifeblood out here. So these events are already being observed, and they're observed at something like 1.2 degrees Fahrenheit warming in the last many decades, and we're projecting that as an absolute minimum additional warming in the next several decades, and we're probably likely to be much more than that. So that's why people are gearing up, because it does take a generation or two to change an energy system. So we're going to be committed to a substantial amount of change in the pipeline. We're going to have to learn to adapt with it, while at the same time we're trying to slow down the really long-term emissions that could put us in the utterly catastrophic outcomes, like massive species extinctions and things like that, you know, 50 or 100 years down the line.
We have just about 30 seconds left before we have to go to a break, Steve Snyder. But is it true that in the short term, agriculture in the United States may gain somewhat?
Well, it's true that some crops might do better through the combination of CO2 fertilization and warmer temperatures, particularly in the higher latitudes, but it's mixed. There's still debate on it, and almost all the literature suggests if we warm up more than a few degrees, they all flip to negative.
Okay. Steve Snyder, Martin Perry, both co-authors of the working group number two, Martin Perry, the co-chair of that organization. We will be back to continue this conversation with him and with others in just a moment. On Reporter's Notebook later, President Bush, immigration reform, and differences that cross party lines. Back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
A complete archive of past programs is available online at kcrw.com/to the point. You can also order a CD copy by calling 1-888-600-5279.
Warren Olney back with To the Point, talking today about the report of Working Group Number 2 of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, indicating that there's now tangible evidence that global warming and climate change are happening much more quickly than had been thought, and that the consequences will be experienced much sooner than had been anticipated in the past. There are dissenters. Our next guest is not necessarily one of them, but he's covered them. He's Andrew Revkin, reporter on the environment for the New York Times, author of The North Pole Was Here, Puzzles and Perils at the Top of the World. Andrew Revkin, always good to have you with us.
It's good to be on.
I gather there really is not much a difference of opinion as to the fact that there is global warming and has been for a century and a half, and that greenhouse gas emissions have a lot to do with it. But beyond that, the question would be how calamitous the future might be. What are those described earlier by Martin Perry as skeptics saying about this?
Well, you've kind of laid out fairly well, as I've been trying to do recently in some stories, amid all the polarization that you get in the sort of in the mainstream media. I guess the New York Times is part of the mainstream media, but I try to kind of step out and provide a little more clarity. But what we tend to hear is just from the absolute edges. It's a catastrophe or it's a hoax. And there's tons that everyone agrees on, even some of the staunchest skeptics on the more alarming pictures of what lies ahead agree that greenhouse gases warm the world. If they weren't there, it'd be an ice ball, and that more of them will make the world warmer. And when you look back in history, history is not a function of opinion. The world's warmer periods had a lot less ice and a lot higher seas. So some of these things are just kind of crystal clear. And you do have, though, a very legitimate and wide range of opinions on what to do about it. And these range from those who say, just make everybody wealthier and we'll figure out how to fix everything, or limit the risks by, you know, coming up with new ways to live with less vulnerability. And then there are those who say we really need to have an aggressive response on these emissions now, which would be pretty costly, depending on who you talk to. There are different economists with different theories about that, too. So that, but there, you know, there's been some sense out there that it's sort of impolitic to have any doubt about this whole question, when in fact the underlying science is crystal clear. What gets much harder is this judgment of what society should do about it right now. In other words, how much adaptation, how much mitigating of the emissions, which wouldn't have an impact for a couple decades at least anyway.
Every action has its consequences, both intended and unintended. So presumably there's plenty of room for debate.
Well, yeah, and the world, there's all these inconvenient realities out there. We just did a set of stories last week leading up to the IPCC process. They're all stacked at nytimes.com/earth, which lay out what I call the climate divide, that most of the impacts that are in this report are the most imminent ones, the most severe ones, come in the places that are both poorest, least able to deal with them, and also that haven't been in high gear economically long enough to have contributed emissions that are responsible for them. So they're kind of paying the price for our century-long binge of fossil fuel burning. And that's, and then the question arises, what do we owe them? And that none of that's really been addressed yet. It's just starting to be addressed.
Andrew Revkin with the New York Times. Eileen Claussen is president of the Pew Center on Global Climate Change, a student of the issues that we're talking about. And Eileen Claussen, thank you very much for joining us.
Delighted to be here.
Do you think that, based on what we just heard from Andrew Revkin, one part of the world has a moral obligation to the rest of the world?
Yes, I do. I mean, if you look at cumulative greenhouse gas emissions in the atmosphere, we are by far the most responsible. And even though we're going to have impacts in the United States, I think this report from the IPCC is clear that the greatest impacts will be in the poorer parts of the world. So, yes, I think we have a moral responsibility to address this. Not that we can do it alone, but we certainly have a responsibility to be there and start reducing our emissions.
Do we also have obligations of another kind? Are there economic consequences that we could avoid by being helpful to these other parts of the world in dealing with these changes?
Well, yes. I mean, part of the difficulty with the debate on the costs of doing something about this is that it fails to take into account the costs of not doing something about this. And that's true whether the not doing something about this affects us or other parts of the world. So, I mean, I think there is no question that there is an economic argument that it is in our interest to do this. It's also in our interest because we have been very good historically at technological innovation. So if there is an opportunity here to move to new technologies, which I think we're going to have to do, why are we lagging behind and just basically going with the old technologies when it's the new ones that are going to be what counts in the 21st century?
Eileen Claussen with the Pew Center on Global Climate Change. Andrew Revkin, back to you. Obviously, politics plays an enormous role in all of this, and particularly here in the United States, but everywhere else as well, one assumes. How far along are we in the United States in dealing with this? It would appear that we have states that want to do more than the federal government is doing, and so on. Where do we stand here? How sophisticated is our conversation so far?
Well, the conversation is getting more sophisticated in the policy arena, although in the public arena, boy, it's still a kind of a mess. I just was rereading the Pew Center on the Press and the Public, their January survey of American attitudes, and Eileen knows a lot about this too, but there's this divide in our consciousness, in our view of this issue that is deep and profound, and it's ideological. It's not based on new information or an education. One of the most jarring parts of this survey was that Republicans who are more educated, in other words, Republicans with college degrees, have more doubts about the dangers of global warming than those that don't, that have no college degree. And Democrats are just the opposite. The more education they have, the more likely they are to see it as a serious problem needing action. And boy, does that, as a journalist, that really presents you with a headache, because it means no matter how well I write a story about this, it's not going to really necessarily shift people who are in those trenches.
Eileen Claussen, back to you. Over on the other side of your organization, the Pew Center that deals with a public opinion, how do you reconcile what we just heard, that these different positions in this very polarized climate politically in this country?
I mean, I think part of what's happening, and I'm actually not an expert on that side of things, is that people tend to believe those with whom they agree on a number of things, that they are telling them the truth on everything. And so I think there are Republicans who only read certain kinds of material, and they believe them, whether it's the editorial page of the Wall Street Journal or whatever. And the same would be true on, let's say, the readers, of the New York Times, who are inclined to believe what's in the New York Times. And so I think you just, because we still have this kind of polarized debate here, people are listening to the people that they trust. And it isn't affected, apparently, by new information or objective analysis.
Let me go back to Steve Schneider at Stanford, one of the authors of this IPCC report. It's my understanding that during the discussions between scientists and government bureaucrats who had to sign off on this before it was released, that there were a lot of debates, many of which were essentially political. Is that correct?
Well, let me give perspective by saying that 85% of the debates, the governments were helpful. Obviously, we always focus on the lurid, and there was 10 or 15% of the time that there was some debate going on. What frustrated the scientists is that to us, a debate means marshaling intellectual arguments, you know, trying to interpret evidence. And what we got on a couple of key points was an interpretation of evidence, but my country takes the position that. And that's very frustrating to a scientist when an oil-producing country or when one of the largest coal burners in the world who's planning to build its economy that way just simply stonewalls without competent scientific argument and refuses to write what the scientists consider to be high-confidence statements. That becomes a unifier across the scientists. And it got pretty testy after we were up about 40 hours at 10 in the morning of an all-night session. And when one of the scientists protested, the room broke out into applause. I'd never seen that before in my life. It was really quite dramatic. The problem is that we shouldn't over-focus on that. Most of the report, the government's actually helped us make it clearer, but a couple of key items, they really were dumbed down, to be blunt. And the U.S., by the way, was not the prime cause of that. The U.S. actually, for the most part, behaved pretty well as not just a peacemaker or compromiser, and they sort of helped us get through it with a few exceptions.
What was dumbed down and who dumbed it down?
Well, the worst part, in my opinion, was that we have a table of effects where we map via temperature, you know, 1 to 2 degrees, you start to pick up effects, but by 4 to 5, the effects become really intense and potentially catastrophic. The real question is, so when do you get 3 degrees or 5 degrees? In order to do that, you have to relate it to how far in the future it occurs and how much emissions it takes, what scenario you use. Well, we had the temperatures and the scenarios right up above the chart, and the Chinese and the Saudis in particular just absolutely would not do it. Remember, the UN works on consensus. Consensus doesn't mean 9 out of 10. It means everybody. 1 or 2 countries can block. The U.S. was a really good citizen on that. They really worked hard to keep that in the report. They took out some other stuff they shouldn't have, but they certainly did a great job on that one. We lost because 2 major countries saying no meant it isn't in there. And I think that what that does is it makes it harder for people to realize how close some of this is and how committed we are to potentially dangerous changes. Another thing that was taken out was the relationship to the Rio conference from 1992, the UN Framework Convention. where what is dangerous climate change? Well, the report doesn't answer it, but it gave you a way to try to analyze it. And the U.S. took that out because I don't think it likes the reference to Article 2 because it's too close to the Kyoto Protocol. So I thought the U.S. didn't behave too well on that one. But, you know, if they only messed up two or three and were helpful on 80, I was actually surprised that they were pretty positive in the meeting.
Eileen Clausen, back to you with the Pew Center. Isn't it true that the Kyoto protocols just referred to are effectively old news at this point? They would expire in 2012, even if the United States did agree to them. My understanding is what's really important is what happens next.
Absolutely. I mean, I think we need a global framework beyond 2012 that really directly includes all the major emitting countries. I mean, there are 20 or 25 countries who account for 85% of all emissions, and those countries have to be real participants in what comes next.
Martin Perry, back to you, the co-chair of the working group number two. Will there be, in subsequent reports by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, efforts to reach consensus to try to resolve some of these differences, particularly that have to do as much with the politics and economics, one would guess, of China and Saudi Arabia and the United States, for that matter, as they do with science?
Well, there's still one third to go, the remaining third of the fourth assessment on mitigation, as it's called, reducing emissions. And there's a synthesis report due to be agreed next November. And that's the end of the fourth round of assessments. So that's 20 years. That's every 5 years, four assessments, 20 years. Whether there's a fifth assessment, that the UN and its government members remains to decide. But would the next agreement seek to achieve, would the next assessment agreed achieve agreement? No, that's not the point, Warren. The point of the UN assessments, this IPCC, is to consolidate what we know. And the hard work that Steve talked about through the night on the fourth day was achieving buy-in by 100 governments into the knowledge base. It becomes a benchmark of knowledge that they buy into. It's the science base then to which the various agreements look back to for knowledge. So the point of the IPCC is not to necessarily achieve agreement in, you know, in action terms, but to achieve a benchmark of knowledge. And Steve mentioned, I think, 85% I scribbled down here. I think that's fair. We've got buy-in by governments at the UN level to the benchmark of knowledge, and I think that's an important step. From here on, what actions are taken at the negotiating level, the UN framework of Convention on Climate Change, etc., you know, Kyoto, etc., and the son and daughter of Kyoto, those are other matters for the politicians.
Eileen Clausen, back to you at the Pew Center. In the meantime, what's the most important thing that the United States could and should be doing, in your opinion, over the next few years?
Well, I think the first thing is for us to get our own house in order and have a real policy here in the United States that would result in reduced emissions. I don't think we can play a constructive role globally, which I think we have to, until we get our own house in order. So I would say we have a real legislative agenda to try to pass some legislation that would put us on a downward path in terms of our emissions. Then, and I'm sorry you asked me for one thing, but it's really the second, we also have to play a key role globally so that we can have a framework post-2012 that does include the major emitters and gets all of us moving in the right direction.
Does the United States, as the major emitter, we all know the statistics having to do with how few people we have relative to the amount of emissions that we are responsible for and so on, suggest that the United States has to take action? And when you say have a legislative agenda, you mean not just drawing up policies but actually doing something. And if so, what should be done first?
I think we need three things. I think we need a cap on U.S. emissions with a series of decreasing caps so that we're actually reducing emissions over the next 10, 20, 30 years. I think we have to do something specific related to coal. We burn a huge amount of coal. There's a technology that we have to fully develop and demonstrate so that we can capture the carbon emissions and sequester them, which is crucial if not only we, but China and India and other major coal-burning countries are going to be able to address this problem. And third, we have to deal with transportation, because that's about a third of the problem. And we have made very little progress in transportation in the U.S. in terms of reducing emissions. So I think we need all three. We need legislation passed, and we need specific targets and timetables that put us on the path to reducing emissions.
Steve Schneider, Andrew Revkin, back to you with the New York Times to talk about cap on emissions, sequestering emissions from coal, dealing with the transportation industry. You sort of multiply the number of special interests involved every time you tick off one of those things. What is there in the Congress at the moment in terms of some sort of comprehensive a plan for dealing with this? Is there anything at all, or are they sort of chipping away at aspects of it?
Well, there's a range of bills that are floating out there now at various stages of either being introduced or discussed, and they range from very sharp, draconian kind of cuts to a very mild approach where the focus is to get the mechanisms in place for capping and trading and not worry so much about the firmness of the cap. Bingaman had a bill that is along those lines. It's being rewritten right now, I think. I don't keep track of that closely. So there's a whole range there. The one thing that the economists I talked to a lot for stories we did this past year under the rubric The Energy Challenge, which are still online also, they say that the one thing that the political process is not good at that you really need here is lock-in, that one bill... One bill, just as Kyoto on the international scale was a tiny, tiny little baby step, not even a step, just sort of toe in the water, is insufficient to guarantee to the markets, to the investors, the people who are going to build a power plant that will last 50 years, that they have confidence that they can move ahead with an investment on a cleaner option rather than a dirty one. They're not going to do it on the basis of one bill. They want to have the idea that emissions are going to be curbed progressively at a certain pace for a long time to come.
Steve Schneider, we're basically out of time, but one question that probably calls for a longer answer than we have time for, but we're focusing here on the idea of mitigating the greenhouse gases. We began the program talking about what we have to do to prepare for inevitable effects. What's the answer to that in the very near term?
Well, we have to sequence it, right? People won't do anything, as Andy and Eileen said, until they really appreciate the problem. So I like to say, let's start smart. We can get very fast returns by building efficiency standards, by standards on appliances and refrigerators, and I hate to say it, on automobiles. And we have massive subsidies for heavy SUVs when, in fact, there should be penalties. That can bring us mitigation without having to wait 30 years. It can't solve the whole problem, and maybe only tens of percent, but it gets started. Then in the long term, we have to have the caps and other things that Eileen talked about, and none of it works over the century if we don't have really good bargains with the Chinese and the Indians and other major emitters, because they say, my God, you guys got a factor of 10 more per capita emissions than us. When we catch up to you, we'll take targets. If that's the case, we're quintupling CO2. We've got to bargain with people. We have to help them leapfrog over the Victorian Industrial Revolution. It requires leadership, and leadership requires cooperation. And we're in the middle of a very long dance to try to get there. It's going to take a generation and a half, and we're maybe one generation along.
Steve Schneider, a former consultant to the White House during the Nixon, Carter, Reagan, Bush Sr., and Carter administrations, one of the authors of the IPCC report. Thanks to you. Thanks to Martin Perry, the co-chair of Working Group 2 of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. Thanks to Andrew Revkin of the New York Times and Eileen Claussen, president of the Pew Center on Global Climate Change. Good to have all of you with us. On Saturday, thousands of people marched in Los Angeles, some of them claiming that President Bush had broken a promise on immigration reform. Mr. Bush himself had yet to present his latest proposal, but he did it today along Arizona's border with Mexico. More on that in a moment on To the Point.
For more information about To the Point or to sign up for the free podcast, visit kcrw.com/to the point.
Warren Olney back with Reporter's Notebook on To the Point. Near Yuma, Arizona today, President Bush viewed an unmanned aerial surveillance vehicle. He also inspected progress on 700 miles of fencing along the border with Mexico. Then he talked about the need for what he calls comprehensive immigration reform.
It's an emotional issue. as I'm sure you can imagine. People have got deep convictions. And my hope is that we can have a serious and civil and conclusive debate. And so we'll continue to work with members of both political parties. I think the atmosphere up there is good right now. I think people genuinely want to come together and put a good bill together.
President Bush on the Mexican border in Arizona, now on his way back to Washington to try to see what his proposal or how his proposal will do. Jonathan Weissman is congressional reporter for The Washington Post. And Jonathan, as always, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Warren.
Think that people on Capitol Hill genuinely want to come together on this and put a good bill together?
I genuinely think that there are certainly some Democrats, especially Ted Kennedy, that really want this bill. And I think there are some Republicans that really want this bill, mostly George W. Bush. But there are a whole lot of Republicans who are still as opposed as they were last year. And now there are a growing number of Democrats, especially some of these freshman Democrats who were just elected, who cannot give President Bush what he wants.
Why can't the Democrats?
Well, because you know, a lot of these freshman Democrats come from conservative or Republican-leaning areas. They took enormous amount of heat during the campaign. One of the primary attack lines from Republicans in general and the Republican challengers was that they favored amnesty, they favored illegal immigration, and of course that prompted them to make fairly strong strong promises that they would not favor anything that they would call amnesty. And what President Bush wants, President Bush says it's not amnesty, but it has been framed as amnesty. Basically, any proposal that would give an illegal immigrant who is here now, who crossed over illegally, some form of permanent legal status, a lot of conservatives have called amnesty, and a lot of Democrats aren't willing to take it on the chin for this president on this.
Interesting how the party lines kind of break down on this issue. Well, it's my understanding now that the president has a proposal that would require people who have been here, and there are 12 million of them, if they want to get legal status, to pay fines. Is that right? And then to go home again and then return and have to pay fees upon returning?
The fines have always been there. What's new, there was a very detailed PowerPoint display leaked out of the White House a couple of weeks back that indicate that now the White House is thinking that all the illegal immigrants here would have to go back to their home country, would have to pay significant fines, $15,000 or so, and reapply for entry through new legal channels through the U.S. Embassy or the U.S. Consulate, it's a considerable hardening of White House positions. It's a little tricky here because the White House is saying that that was not really a proposal from the White House, that it was a set of ideas that the White House was putting out to Republican senators trying to find a Republican consensus position. And if you listen to the president today, he did not bring up any of those specifics at all. He stuck to the generalities.
Well, some of the Democrats who are in favor of something closer to amnesty than what the president is also have problems, as I understand it, with another aspect of that, which is that you'd get a 3-year visa, but every time it expired, you'd have to go home, then come back and pay another $3,500 fee. Is that right?
Well, what they really don't like is this notion that you would get these 3-year renewable work visas that you could renew indefinitely over and over and over, but you would never get onto some kind of track toward permanent residency through a green card or through for citizenship. They say that would create kind of a permanent underclass, kind of thing that you see in Europe today, in France and in Germany, which has fomented a lot of unrest. And another proposal that was in that PowerPoint display was to deny what they call family unification visas to allow legal immigrants to bring their parents, their grandparents, siblings over to keep the family together. And they would use, instead of giving those visas to family members, they would channel those visas to skilled workers, high-tech workers, things like that, that they say that the economy could use better. And that also is going over very poorly with the Democrats, who are otherwise the president's allies on this issue.
All right. An enormously complicated issue, obviously, in what we always have to remember is a very polarized time, although the polarization is sort of odd from a partisan standpoint on this particular battle. Jonathan Weissman, as always, many thanks.
Thank you.
Congressional reporter for The Washington Post. Today's program produced by Christian Bordahl with Vanessa Romo and Andrea Brody. Our technical director is Mike Newport. For more information about To the Point or to email us, visit kcrw.com/To the Point. I'm Armin Alney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.